I'm Michelle from the Starling Tribune, a proud member of the Gundagik Network, just like the show you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual host. Check out all the other podcasts at GundagikNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is Paul McGann, the Eighth Doctor. You're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Go and throw yourself under a bus. I didn't mean to say that. He told me to say that.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. We invite you to join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi and beyond. Your GPR staff are Jay Whitten.
You see how clever I was there? You make that connection? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Keir Hansen.
Proactive. Reactive. Proactive. I'm making up words as I go here.
And Haley Malley.
Hey, that wasn't exactly what I was going to say at all, Jay. Thanks.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do occasionally discuss recent news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired in their home territories. But don't worry, if we dip too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning. Welcome to episode 237 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where the energy in the studio this week is nearly palpable. You know, it's like that scene in Apollo 13, you know? Come on, Apollo 13? Tom Hanks? Bill Paxton? Ed Harris? Going all MacGyver with air filters and duct tape in the name of American engineering? Seriously. I mean, you all need to step up your movie viewing game. It's like working with chimpanzees in here. I'm your host. My name is Kieran. Joining me in the studio, as always, is my partner in time, Jay Whitten. Jay, how are you feeling today?
Well, you know, there's fire going in the corner, so I think we've got oxygen. We're good.
All right. That's always a good sign. Yep. Hey, chemistry. And over there to the opposite side, just staring at this gold-plated sarcophagi, is Haley Malley. Haley, what's up?
I don't remember seeing that many jewels in Apollo 13.
I guess that's true. Well, what's going on this week, Jay?
Well, this week we're giving Mark Gatiss the keyboard one more time, possibly the last for this foreseeable future, with the off-world Ice Warrior adventure with a slight Victorian twist. So yeah, here we go with Empress of Mars. Strap on your steampunk spacesuits because this is a wild one.
Yeah, we finally officially retired the orange jumpsuits. I thought maybe it'd make one more appearance just for nostalgia's sake, but Haley Neubauer said, no, I got a new design in mind this time. They're freaking cool. I like them.
Yeah, they do look good.
They look a little weird on Nardole.
They work really well to offset the how futuristic they look against the very steampunky spacesuits that we got.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The steampunk spacesuit was a heck of an opening little gambit there. That's pretty cool. I don't know how you want to hold up the idea of a fishbowl helmet as far as its scientific plausibility, but hey, you know,
complete with
nope,
speaking
science,
trumpet.
Fine.
Just let it go.
I checked with Jules Verne. He said it would work.
Sure. And that's kind of one of the things that I think kind of blankets over this episode. There are a lot of things where you're like, what the heck? 1881, I'm on Mars. I'm in the caverns beneath the surface of Mars, and I've got, you know, pith helmets. And seriously, this is what we're doing here? But it didn't faze me in the least. The episode was paced well enough that, let it go.
It felt like an episode of Doctor Who.
Yes.
Yeah. How many shows give you a period piece on Mars?
Right.
I mean, except for John Carter. But
well, as long as you're reading it and not watching it, I guess. But I think one of the things that I saw a lot of reactions to that I was thinking maybe 20 minutes into this, maybe about the moment where you realize Friday's true intent and everything, and you get like the first resurrections, de-hibernations. Of the Ice Warriors, and they start to, you know, move in tandem, and they're saluting, and they're, you know, doing their whole thing, and like, okay, the Ice Warriors are officially back.
Yeah.
You know, not just seeing one or two of them like we had in Cold War or something like that. This made them formidable, and genuinely just when you see their code of honor and everything, that the Doctor is showing them so much respect and trying to placate and appease them at every turn, this was something I was really, really glad to see. It's something I was really hoping to see. I think we talked about this as soon as we knew that the Ice Warriors were going to be back this season, that we all said, I hope that they really do them justice this time around.
And I really think that they did. They went from being, you know, no longer do we consider them, you know, in the class of monsters. You know, they're not a villain. They served the role of antagonist to some extent, though the humans did better job of that. But anyway, it was
funny
one
how
of those
we're
things
capable of that one.
Yeah, weird.
The second in command, kind of a dick. I'm shocked.
Exactly. Just a little bit.
The Riker effect? What? Must be the facial hair. But I mean, the doctor has this phenomenal quote when he's trying to explain. And again, okay, so it requires a little bit of, you know, Bill needs some exposition going through that, at least just initially, because then she gets, and we'll get to this momentarily, she gets her opportunity to really kind of step into the thick of this. But when the doctor's giving the kind of the breakdown of them, you know, and sort of explaining, okay, they've got this exoskeleton, this carapace that, you know, this combination of biology, technology, and so forth. They're one with it and so forth. And he makes this amazing statement about them. And it's a quote that I hope I see on con ribbons. You know, they could slaughter entire civilizations and weep at the crushing of a flower. And that's something I don't think they've been given that kind of credit before. I mean, they've been talked about how formidable they are. They've been talked about, you know, how militant they can be, or the strength in their numbers, or their code of honor and such, being the consummate warriors. But to be able to put that juxtaposition was something I think very unique, and I got to give Gatiss a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, it was really interesting hearing that, and it seems like Gatiss really understands what made the Ice Warriors cool back in the day. And he's brought that forward in a tremendous way.
I think, and you talk about back in the day, and that really, that shows itself. We're kind of jump ahead a little bit here, but there is, you know, for those unfamiliar, the one-eyed alien that responds to the distress beacon towards the closing minutes there, who announces themselves as the representative Alpha Centauri, is from Curse of Peladon. I mean, we're going all the way back here to Third Doctor. And this is really a matter of Gatiss saying, you know what, Moffat's not the only one who can play the closing the classic Who loop game, and did an amazing job with it. So there's also some interesting, if you want to search it out, go find out who did the voice of Alpha Centauri there, if you want a little extra bonus, just a little cool piece. But I had, if jump back now, let's get back towards the earlier part of the episode. So Nardal goes and runs to the TARDIS and does not witness the controls moving and setting themselves and ultimately bringing him back to the university. I would assume that was the TARDIS's settings to do so. Theories about what was actually at play there?
I kind of wonder if Missy had something to do with it.
From inside the vault?
Well, like she just set something in there on a time delay when the doctor visited last. I don't remember how close she got to the TARDIS at the time. But long game effect, it ended with her out of her vault and in the TARDIS.
Right. Which for might me, explain why she knew how to fix whatever it was before Nardal even had a chance to say what was broken.
For me, it wasn't like I didn't really think so much about the what it meant with the story. My brain automatically went back to Cold War, and I'm like, okay, so apparently Gatiss thinks that the TARDIS just completely nopes anytime they come around the Ice Warriors.
Yeah, because he played the HADS system, which we hadn't heard from since Second Doctor when he played that card in Cold War. So, granted, we didn't see it actually enact itself. We just saw the TARDIS dematerializing, comes back at the end of the episode. Okay, you guys all done? Safe for me to come back? Because I was behind a rock. Is that all right? I don't know. I don't mind the idea of the HADS system. You know, it has logical rationale to it. I just don't want to see it overused, because I think the TARDIS's relationship with the Doctor is such that she looks out for him just as much as he looks to protect her. So I don't think she would always hightail it for the hills every time things could look a little dicey. And this wasn't, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I mean, they've faced more formidable challenges than this. And TARDIS has been under more direct fire. So,
yeah, I think it, for me, the immediate reaction I went to thinking about it after the fact was, it was probably just a, there's people who don't understand the technology that they're using, a lot of things, different things going on, the Ice Warriors really trying to do anything to get there. The TARDIS probably just said, you know what, me being here is just going to make the situation even more volatile. Mm. So she noped on out of there. And
So I know I definitely want to talk about Bill stepping up once she gets an opportunity to realize that she can bend the ear, or at least gain the attention of Araxa as the Empress Queen. But before we do, I just want to ask, so did anyone for a hot second look at Jackdaw and think Bob Hoskins? Just for a second.
I was wondering what it was that seemed so familiar to me.
Yeah, he was playing some serious, Who Framed Roger Rabbit kind of. I will say I was really kind of impressed with a lot of the supporting cast. Bio, I'm never going to pronounce his last name. Batamosi, I'm going to say it's Batamosi, who played Vinci, was so enjoyable. I was just saying, he's got the girl back home. He's talking about, just wanting to be able to return. And I'm thinking to myself, how does the chronology of this work? Because if they ever get back, what, do they all get retconned or something? Or the fact that they've had, off-world adventures in 1881?
They just don't ever talk about it. And one of them goes on to write the Princess of Mars series.
Of course.
As soon as he started talking about his sweetheart back home, I'm like, and you're dead.
Yeah, this was probably one of the most overt body squishing episodes. There were a whole lot of meatballs being made.
Yeah.
Really got disturbing after about the third one. Oh, do they have to bounce when they hit the ground?
At least they weren't like liquidy. Like nothing came out of them.
Yeah, it all nice and plastic and yeah.
Yeah, she didn't break the casing.
Yeah. Yeah, even though there must have been a lot of bones getting pulverized.
Yeah, I mean that could have been a lot more grotesque if they'd wanted to go that way.
All right. So thanks effects crew. Doing us a solid on that one. How about as far as the idea of using this as a platform to be able to break down a lot of patriarchal norms? Bill makes the joke about, that Victorian mindset and language of yours. Oh, all right. Well, I'm gonna let you go on this one because you are actually Victorian. But that's about as far as it is allowed to go. And from that point on, between her mindset and the Empress's slams, this is a strong feminist episode.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean the Empress even says that at one point. What was the quote that she had? Like, she looks at Bill and asking for her advice. She goes, "We're both surrounded by noisy males. What do you say?"
Yeah, and that's really kind of the cut through it. So, and it's always kind of fascinating to me. I mean, it's something where a lot of our entertainment sources may just fall back on patriarchal standards, but when you really think about it, some of the most fascinating historical studies and things that we have, or even things that are happening present day, but in much marginalized opportunities, are those matriarchal communities and social constructs that don't really get a whole lot of mainstream attention. Well, haven't to date. But this idea of saying, okay, if I have to take you completely off planet Earth to show you what a strong warrior empire would look like under a matriarchal construct, then we're going to do that. And you're going to see that they are both, that they maintain their strength, they maintain their honor, they maintain their code of conduct, they maintain their degree of respect and dignity and power. They're just not what you're accustomed to. So you might need to kind of widen your scope quite a bit. But yeah, I was extremely pleased to see that. And going back to some of the discussion we've had in the last couple of weeks about whether or not there's always some sort of a social agenda, so what? There's a reason why it's being presented, because it's time where you can take a platform like this, you can take a venue and an opportunity to be able to say, all right, we're going to put it right into your entertainment. And so however you need to accept it, you know, it's like different paths to learning. You know, if you're the type that needs to get it from a book, you need to get it from a visual entertainment source. You need to be able to get it from your musical enjoyment, whatever it takes to get through to you, whatever's going to make it actually sink in, then we'll provide it, because it's time to start kind of wearing down the corners on all of this BS. So I'm really glad it was here. And as a result, and we're going to get to this momentarily, this may be my favorite Mark Gatiss episode ever.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, I actually have to agree with you on that one. I thought this was a good, solid episode. It didn't stray off of the rails. There was nothing that really drew you out of it. You know, like we talked about, the bouncy meatballs may have been unsettling, but that wasn't script. That was, you know, effects.
That was effects. Yeah.
I mean, as far as the script and the dialogue went, this was a solid episode. Mm. I was really, really surprised.
Yeah. There was one line that had me a little worried when she was like, you know, my ice warrior, sleep no more. And I was like, oh no, yes. Where's she going with this?
Okay. Yeah. Right. And Julie and I turned to each other and she said, honestly, there were 1,000 different ways that you could have made a statement asking your warriors to come out of their sleep chambers. So rise and shine, wakey wakey.
Arise.
Arise and conquer. Anything. But did she have to say it 3 times to just sell it? And I wrote Sleep No More. Sleep No More was another episode that I wrote. I'm not ashamed. You didn't like it?
Sleep No More.
Wow.
Yeah, that definitely seemed a little bit Rita Repulsa to me, though. I half expected her to be like, you know, make my monster grow. So, yeah.
But
I mean, if that is the biggest complaint that I get out of a Mark Gatiss episode, I'm thrilled.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And mark your calendars, kids, because this is coming from Jay Whitten of Gallagher Public Radio, and you all know where he stands on that. For those of you who also delve into things like some of the extended novels and the Big Finish audio and things, you'll take an additional layer from this. And obviously it's very clear, because Gatiss has actually also written for a lot of Big Finish audio, or at least a handful of stories that I know of, that you'll be looking at this and saying, all right, well, the Ice Warriors aren't really necessarily, as Jay alluded to earlier, they're not really the villains in this. Our second in command is the villain here. There was a long stretch once you get past Cursed Peladon, Monster Peladon, and then odd into the related stories, both visual and audio, where the Ice Warriors are just sort of involved. They're there. There are representatives of them, but they're either being held in check or they're being used as muscle. Or they just have representatives within the scene, and has to do with multiple species in the confrontation. So going back to what we were talking about, the Alpha Centauri thing and that welcome to the universe thing, that really sets a lot in motion. That actually gets us to Pertwee and Peladon. So this is your little preamble. So again, Gatiss is kind of closing the loop on that. But because at this point, the Doctor has established such a resounding respect for them, or at least has demonstrated that respect, that puts everything on a good footing right now, chronologically going forward. We as humans totally screw that up later, but we fix it again, 2017, and then we take a little leap back. Nice to see, by the way, that NASA has not changed their interior, and that it's all just wood paneling and big boom mics all over the place.
Yeah, it's comfortable.
They're on a government budget.
Yeah, there's really not a lot left in the kitty to put some nice drywall up. That paneling, boy, that was dirt cheap back in 1954.
When the paneling falls off, they'll replace it.
Yeah, sure.
And that was the last time that NASA had any kind of money to spend, so.
Mm, okay, which brings us to this lovely final scene where Nardal is apologetically following the Doctor back into the TARDIS, and you get that great framed shot of wild ass hair, Missy, stepping from just behind the time rotor and having a very brief conversation with the Doctor about, oh, you know, I'm willing to go back in the vault, sure, but you got to tell me first, are you all right? And she keeps stressing that. What is she seeing? Don't everybody jump in on this one. Because I don't know if it's something where, you know, she's, you know, it's either a shark smelling blood in the water and she knows that something's up with him. Like she can smell the regeneration coming, or if there's something else entirely that we haven't really had an opportunity yet to play with for the, you know, our last few episodes of the season.
Yeah, I don't know.
See, I was just thinking she was trying to demonstrate in that moment that she has concern for his well-being, and is just trying to jockey for a position on the TARDIS instead of back in the vault.
Hmm. So it was just a distraction technique?
Basically.
I don't know. I mean, if we're taking Missy on faith, can't believe we're actually taking Missy on faith, but if the psychotherapy is actually working, and she does have, and she is more willing to express her genuine concern for who she considers to be her greatest Time Lord friend, frenemy, friend, call it what you will, then this is a legitimate statement. But I guess because it came so out of the blue, that it wasn't as if there were moments through the rest of the episode where he was taking like the dramatic pause or you know, looking off into the distance and thinking about something, and someone has to say, "Doctor, are you with us?" And I'm off, you know. So it's not like he was tipping his hand to anything, but she's seeing something. I don't know. I'm hoping it's just Occam's razor and she's just kind of seeing the regeneration on the way. Well, I'm not hoping, but I that's what I figure.
Unless there's some sort of residual effect on him from what the monks did to fix his vision.
Mm. Yeah, and we never did get an explanation as to how the heck they can manipulate reality. They can falsify memories, but we never did get an explanation as to how they could actually change the material nature of the reality we're living in. A lot of people had theories that everything we were just seeing during those three episodes was just another simulation, but that went out the window.
Mm. I was this close to believing that they were going to say, oh, the whole season so far has been in the second level of simulation.
All right, yeah. Let's play the Whovian Inception game.
Yep.
Well, I don't know. But I think the consensus is this was a real strong episode. Real glad that we got back to a one and done coming off that arc, which was a little rocky.
Yeah.
But this genuinely kind of redeemed where everything is right now, or just gave us a fun adventure. You know, you don't have to take too much away from it, but you can. I mean, you can dig into it and just enjoy it further if you want to. But if you're just watching it on the surface level, one viewing, and just walk away and say, "Yeah, cool, that's kind of a fun thing. You know, it's weird, 1880s, but I'm on Mars, and yeah, all right, I got it." And who knew? Gatiss at the pen.
Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of how I went with it. This, for the first time, and I don't even know how long, I only watched it one time before we recorded.
Okay.
So did I.
Partly because I was so pleased with it after the first viewing, I didn't want to ruin it.
It's not a particularly deep episode. Mm-hmm. So, or I should say, particularly complex or convoluted. So it's not as if you feel compelled to watch it multiple times to work things apart. It's right. It's relative. I hate to use the word shallow, but it's simplified. You know, it's just a straightforward, you know, people are saying what they mean, meaning what they say. You get it on the first shot. Nobody's farting around with subtext or you know, double entendre or anything. And you know where everybody stands. You know, Doctor's trying to smooth things out. Bill's trying to absorb and serve as a sort of an ambassador. Hello, human. That's me. great opening sequence, by the way. What a humanistic thing to say. That's me, human. Hi.
Yeah.
But yeah, it works first time out of the gate. So I think that leads us kind of nicely into what we wanted to do for our little extra segment here. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So as I had mentioned to the folks who follow us on Facebook, we are at the point now where this is obviously our episode 237. And if you look back historically, the 237th Doctor Who story happened to be Crimson Horror, also written by Mark Gatiss. We talked about that one. We had mixed opinions on that one, as we often do with the stuff that comes from the pen of Mark Gatiss. But we kind of opened it up to folks. By the way, for those of you who are Facebooky and do the Facebookery, go ahead and check us out there. Find this post. I think I pinned it to the top so that people can find it quickly. But we're running a bit of a contest, going to give away some free goodies. Keeping things open until I'll close things on Friday, 23rd of June. So you can get a chance. Read it over. Pop in a contribution. You'll get an entry into the running here for some free stuff. And it was basically just a discussion of kind of how do you feel? Because we've heard of the news that Mark won't be writing for Chibnall's first season at the Swing. So, and he doesn't know what the future holds. So this may very well be, as Jay said at the intro, this may be the last time we have a Gatiss written episode, at least for televised too. So looking back a little bit, you know, how do we kind of feel about things? We got some interesting responses and we'll continue to kind of pour through it, but it goes along really well with some polls that have been going around about the people's take on favorite Gatiss episodes. And it seems right now, I'll mention the kind of, so the poll structure, and then I want to get to a question I want to pose to the two of you. And it really is kind of a two sides of a coin thing that I want to get your opinions on. The voting polls that are going around right now with one of the Facebook groups that we stay pretty vocal with is saying that as far as really enjoyable, Gatiss episodes, Empress is killing it right now. Unquiet Dead would be a very close second,
Which one was Unquiet Dead?
Unquiet Dead was where we were dealing
Ninth Doctor and Rose and
right. It's where you've got Eve Miles and
Charles Dickens
seeing the ghosts.
Okay,
right. Crimson Horror came in third. Okay, take that as you will. And then the fourth position currently is tied between The Robot of Sherwood and Victory of the Daleks, and then they descend down pretty steeply from there. Idiot's Lantern, Night Terrors, Sleep No More, Lazarus Experiment, they're all sitting pretty low. Oh, I'm sorry. Cold War is right on there with Crimson Horror.
Okay.
But so the discussion was starting to come around that, and I'll thank some friends of the cast who are actually pretty vocal with us on a regular basis. Drew Meyer, who actually is with used to be with Gallifrey Pirate Radio and is now with Doctor Who and Company, another good podcast out there on the network. Kathleen Showalter, who we've had on the cast for some of our game panels for cons and things, and Heather McHale also joined us on a few panels. They were talking about the fact that with Gatiss episodes, you can look at them one of two ways. You can either say he writes really good stories that have moments that kind of and pull you out of it, or he writes stories that are kind of that have moments that say, all right, well, that was clever. I'll give you points for that one. Or, oh, that was a good pull, or that was a nice connection to continuity. I'll give you that one. And it seemed to be kind of, people were toggling back and forth on that and falling into different camps. Jay, I know you've been a pretty reluctant acceptor of Gatiss stories. You know, certain ones will strike you. You know, I think we're all in agreement on Cold War. We really loved Empress and things like that. And you know, you may be okay with some of the others, you know, Unquiet Dead and such. But would you consider him to be a good story writer who every once in a while just hits a speed bump that throws you from the car? Or would it be something where he really doesn't write very good stories, but he has moments in there that'll say, all right, give you kudos for that?
This is difficult. If I'm going basically just off of what I've seen on Doctor Who and not taking any of his other work into it.
Yeah, and I think you kind of have to, because that's the sort of the backdrop of where this whole line of questioning came about, was just strictly his tenure with Doctor Who specifically.
I'd have to say that he writes decent moments.
Okay.
Because I've always said that he has tremendous ideas. Like he comes up with great concepts for the stories. It's just the execution that falls flat for me.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, a lot of times it goes off the rails or something like that. So yeah, I'd have to say that it's the, you know, the concepts are great and he puts in some great moments in there, but he has trouble tying it all together to a cohesive story.
Mm. All right. Haley, how would you feel you fall in those two camps?
Well, I'm going to answer by not picking A or B and saying my own thing, which is I feel like he does. He's a good idea man, and he's pretty good with like character and dialogue and those parts. But when it comes to plot, that's his weakest part. He can't necessarily finish out the structure of a story on his own.
Okay. Usually at the tail end, you would say?
It could fall apart anywhere, but usually the weak parts are plot.
Okay. I guess that holds. I mean, I liked Unquiet Dead throughout. I really didn't have any issue with that one. Then again, though,
I don't remember it. It's been so long since I've seen season one.
Yeah, well, it's in such an early stage of the program's revival that we just kind of took everything. We were just appreciative to have it, and they were really just toying around with things. So any story was an enjoyable story, and it really was. I like the fact that it gave a very interesting twist on what could have been a ghost story, but it turned out not to be. It was one of those instances where I liked the clever nature of how they were handling the idea of spectral anomalies, and Eve Miles come out. But from a story perspective, I think it held up well. Idiot's Lantern, yeah, that I think that might fall into something where you had three quarters of a solid concept there, and then it was just a matter of, all right, how can I extend this from short story format into something that's going to run 53 minutes and really hold everyone's interest? Well, I'll just make the Doctor and Rose just extra cute. You know, we'll give them their daddy old moments and such. Victory of the Daleks, I can't.
Yeah, no, that
Pez Daleks, I can't.
I mean, the idea of, you know, World War II soldiers taking on a Dalek, interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an interesting concept, but yeah, no. That was about the only thing that worked for that.
Notice that Gates is very big on period pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And he likes putting the juxtaposition of heavy technology or modern or futuristic adversaries in period construct. So Daleks in 1940s, you've got in Cold War, you've got the Ice Warriors in the 1980s, or now we've gone back to the 1880s. You know, Robot of Sherwood. So now you've got your golden whatever the heck they were aliens in the middle of a potentially fictional Sherwood Forest. We don't really know whether we were in a real place or not. Golden arrows, indeed. Crimson Horror, you know, another instance where you've got rocketry and so forth in the middle of that Victorian. No, that wasn't Victorian, sorry. But yeah, so that seems to be his comfort zone. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I guess I would probably say that he's generally, I don't know if I'd say like three quarters of his stories or that his stories tend to get about 75% of the way there. And then there are just these moments that kind of clunk you out of it, because there are so many instances where he'll flip it and it's the other way around. You know, I'll look at Cold War, I'll look at Unquiet Dead, I'll look at what he just wrote this past week on Empress, and he's got it. It's all there. And I don't know whether it was because he had an executive editor who stepped in and said, "Nah, let's just pull that big long soliloquy that you had that really didn't connect to anything. Let's just leave that over there." But Jay, to go back to your point about saying whether or not we're looking at this entirely within Doctor Who, if I said that those blinders were off and that you were looking beyond that scope and now looking into something like his collaboration on Sherlock, how would that change the way that you, just for ha-has, how would that change the way that you viewed his story writing?
I think he's a good writer. I think he's a really good writer. I think that his heart gets in the way with Doctor Who.
Okay. His desire to do something grand with it, or?
Yeah, he's a huge fanboy and likes to bring a lot of stuff from the, I think what it typically turns out to be is that he tries to tie into the classic stuff so much because that's what he knows and that's what he loves. But he's trying to do it for a modern audience, and he just can't make that connection half the time because he's either trying too hard to bring the classic stuff, or he's, yeah, it's not tying in the way that he wants it to or something. I don't know what the disconnect is, but there's something there that just, he can't get them to connect right. He would try and write a classic Doctor Who story, and it didn't work in the context of the new series, or he was trying to bring something forward that just had no business coming forward into the show or something. I don't know. I'm not sure what it is that causes the problem, but
it's funny. At times we almost put Moffat under the same critique, but mm-hmm. I think he might be a little bit more self-aware of when it's going beyond just being clever, and now it's starting to become a bit of an obstacle. So
I think Moffat tends to have some of the same stumbles, but his bright spots are so bright that you're willing to overlook them more often than with Gatiss.
Mm. Okay, so to go back to that dichotomy of saying, is it the story that that shines and these moments that dull it, or is it a dull story with moments that shine? If you're putting that up against Moffat's highs and lows, he's got, I should say, Stephen's got the shining moments that vastly outglow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, the conversation is still ongoing, so I absolutely invite folks to jump over to that thread and chime in on it. Plus, you could get a chance to win some free stuff, so hey, you can't go wrong with that too. On my dime for shipping. That's what I'm talking about. And I'll get it to you fast. You won't even believe how fast. It'll be so fast. It'll be
somebody
fastest
from thing. Antarctica, please, please enter our competition with something brilliant.
Oh, the contest was won by a pengling. Who cast this entry for these penguins? All right. News time?
Yeah, news time.
Indeed. Where do you want to start?
Since we're already on a divisive topic, let's go ahead and throw this one out there. So Russell T. Davies got interviewed recently. And I mean, of course, you know, you're interviewing the previous showrunner of the show. So why not? Let's rope him into current events and ask if he knows who's going to replace Peter Capaldi as the Doctor. Mm-hmm. During the course of the interview, he wound up saying, you know, it's not my job. You know, I left the show. This is all on their heads. You know, it's their thing. They're running it. I have no input in this. I don't, but of course I know.
Yeah. Yes. Well,
why wouldn't he?
Because I'm Russell T. Davies.
What
could be the harm in letting me know? I mean, partially responsible for keeping this program alive. And so it, as a courtesy, sure, just let me know. And I'm going to keep completely shtum about it, mostly. Mm-hmm. But then they start getting into playing these games about, you know, it's like blink twice for this, nod your head. No, don't breathe if I guess the right person kind of thing. And they're just not going to play that game. So, but yeah, you can go ahead and listen to the little bit of the clip from it and take from it what you will. But we still absolutely adore Russell. He's been kind of hilarious lately. Divulge all that through our Twitter thread. You can chat with us that way. But yes, I'm glad he's still in the mix of things.
I am too. I'm so tired of all of the, like, let's just find out who the next Doctor is when we find out. What does it matter? Don't try and take something away from Capaldi's swan song here.
Yeah, absolutely true. I'd like to find out, you know, maybe November. I'd be okay with that.
The only reason I want to find out sooner is because I'm sick of all the speculation articles.
Yeah, that's the only problem that I'm running into now is, like, you know, the sooner we find out, the sooner they can all put it to bed.
I put mute filters on all my social media now, so anything that has next Doctor in it just gets completely masked out. I don't even see it. Not really.
That's the way to do it.
But speaking of blinking twice or anything of that sort, this past week was the 10th anniversary of the airing of Blink. So our little weeping angels are 10 years old today. They don't look a day over 9.
Does this photo make it look like the angel is dabbing?
Yes.
A little bit, yes.
Yes. Well, there was actually when all of the UK elections, the snap elections were going through this past week, and Lord Buckethead threw some dab on it when he was up on the dais with the rest of all of the candidates. I think it was Chip from over at This Week in Time Travel and 2 Minute Time Lord who put this collage together of all of these Whovian villains that had been in this pose before. There's like 4 or 5 of them. And it ends with Lord Buckethead. Okay, Chip, you tip my hat to you on that one. I tip my giant bucket hat because that was well played. The Weeping Angels were among them. But yeah, so the story apparently was that there was, and I'm sure Moffat's got hundreds of these stories that he could potentially share, was that Sally Sparrow was going to have a very different ending, or at least a final moments in the Blink episode. Little macabre, or a little, dare we say, a little Angels Take Manhattan? Insofar as the fact that she could potentially have been thrown back into the past, and Larry doesn't actually see her, but finds a painting in which she's waving from sometime that she's been thrown back by the angel's ability to temporarily shift their victims. So that would have been even darker.
Yeah.
It could have worked. I'm thinking about it. It would have made the episode even that much more distressing.
Yeah. It definitely would have made it a bit darker than it ended being. Mm.
You know, in retrospect, it probably would have solved, you know, for the longest time we were wondering about the whole girl in the shop theory.
Yeah.
With Clara. It would have taken Sally completely out of the equation on that one. Because for the longest time, I was holding out hope that the girl in the shop was going to be Sally Sparrow, that she was guiding Clara to the doctor's defense.
That would have been a bit of a stretch, but yeah. But yeah, I don't know. It definitely would have solved the problem of always wanting to see her come back into the show.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not. I mean, the doctor technically does time travel, so.
It would have been nice to see her maybe show up in class, in season 2 of Class.
Yeah.
As they're dealing with the angels again.
Oh, yeah, as a resident expert, and she's been, you know, gathering all the details on. Oh, that would have been great. yeah, just as long as they don't.
Things that might have been.
What's up?
Said things that might have been.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true. Last little piece here, just for a bit of information. We had a near miss. oh, Ian. Apparently in the process of getting ready to shoot Empress of Mars, or when they were in the process of getting that all pulled together, Gatiss gets a text message from Ian McNeice, whom we love.
Oh, yes.
Nipple rings. They were in the process of actually writing Sherlock in Morocco, of all places. Because where else do you go to write Sherlock? Then you go to Morocco.
Well, of course.
But he gets a text message from Ian just saying, can I please come back as Churchill again?
Please.
How can you say no to him? He's adorable. But they couldn't figure out a way to take Winston Churchill and stick him into the 1880s or 2017 or anywhere in between and still come up with some sort of fluidity to the episode. So
no, just the doctor goes back to 1940, whatever, picks up Churchill, and then they go and do whatever adventure they're going to have.
Just stepping stones. Short trips. I just got to stop off. I got to pick up a packet of crisps and then we'll go. Ian, we love you so much. But there you go. That's your little happy to take away for the week. What's going to be happening the next time around? What are we getting ready for? What's next Saturday going to be? Is it official? Is it ready?
So next week we'll be coming back with the Eaters of Light, which this one looks weird.
Yeah, like, doesn't it?
I don't even know what to make of this one.
Roman period piece, centurions being slaughtered by weird glowing Hydra aliens in the woods, taking out entire companies. Oh, yeah. The return of Rona Monroe. We're getting weird.
Yeah. I'm excited for it. I want to see what comes of this.
Yeah.
It looks interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
Have we seen actual real Romans in the new run? Because I think we only got the fake Romans.
Yeah, the Auton centurions.
Yeah.
Not proper Romans. No, I guess not, because when we were dealing with the Vikings and the Celts, Romans there would have been around the right period, but no, they weren't in the scene. So no, not really, I guess. Not proper Romans. Don't you stand in wannabe Romans. Battery operated Romans. That's not fair.
All right. This has been episode 237 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, so which planet do you think we're going to find the carving of Murica? F yeah.
It's on the surface of Venus.
You just can't see it. No, it's on Uranus. No, Uranus. You know it is.
And this is Kier saying, sweet Fanny Adams. That's what.
And this is Haley saying, Araxa, noisy males. I hear you.
What does the pink thing say?
We'll see you next week.
I'll see.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio. Or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Oh shit, hold on, leg cramp.
Ow, holy.
Ow, oh my god. Sweet, merciful fuck nuts.
I'm glad I started recording.
Me too.
Ah! Oh, hamstring, you. Hey, so I'm gonna record from a standing position tonight. You know, here's the funny thing. About
that wasn't the funny thing?
No. Not funny, ha ha. Funny what the hell.